Welcome to the Bregman Leadership Podcast. I'm Peter Bregman, your host and CEO of Bregman Partners. This podcast is part of my mission to help you get massive traction on the things that matter most. Amy Wilkinson is with us today. She's a strategic advisor, entrepreneur, and lecturer at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. She has written a global bestseller, the book The Creator's Code, The Six Essential Skills of Extraordinary Entrepreneurs. And she is here to speak with us about the book today. Amy, welcome to the Bregman Leadership Podcast.
Oh, I'm delighted to be with you. Thanks very much.
So, Amy, this is a very deeply researched book, and I want to talk about the research in a moment. But before I do, let's ground people in what's the big idea of this book, why do you write it, and let's go through the six essential skills.
So the big idea of the book is that we can all create and scale our own ideas. The book's called The Creator's Code, and that's because you can create your own company. The data set is the largest data set on high-scale founders in the United States, but you don't have to found a company that goes to $100 million in revenue, which is the data set. You can also start a small business. You can start a side project. You can be a creator inside of a corporation. You can start a nonprofit. The skills, the code, are the six skills. And we can talk about what those six are. But the big idea is that every single person is able to create and scale a new and innovative idea, and that if you do have these six skills, that there it will highly advantage your ability to do that.
And so you, when you say built to 100 million, you interviewed and included in the data set only leaders who had built companies with a certain time frame. Up to that had built the companies to at least 100 million in valuation.
So yes, the data set is backed by the Kauffman Foundation, which is the largest entrepreneurship foundation in the U.S. I did 5 years of work at Harvard University, and now I was asked to teach. This will be the third year that I teach this material at Stanford Business School to second year students, and the data set is based on 200 interviews, 10,000 pages of transcripts, with the leading entrepreneurs in the U.S. So founders of companies that have gone to scale with $100 million in annual revenue. And what I wanted to see was 5 years of history to eliminate things that would run up and run down as startups, Groupon being an example that we would be familiar with. But I didn't want more than 10 years to go to scale. So it's the largest high-growth, high-scale founders of businesses data set. And it includes founders of companies like many of the tech companies that we all know. So Airbnb, Dropbox, LinkedIn, PayPal, Google, et cetera. Many of the companies out here in Silicon Valley where I live. But also non-tech companies such as Chipotle as a restaurant, Chobani as a Greek yogurt company, Under Armour as a sports brand, Spanx as a women's undergarment, JetBlue as an airline, et cetera. Those were all founders of those companies, took those very quickly to scale. So this is a look across sectors and across the U.S. at what does it take to be a creator that can start kind of anywhere with any type of an idea and grow it very quickly.
That's great. And actually, it leads me to ask you some of the research questions that were in my head before we go into the six. I was going to do it in the opposite direction. But since we're on the research, let's talk about that. And I've always been curious about the, you know, research in this way, because there's clearly, you know, data is so valuable, right? So to be able to talk to all of these people and, you know, over 200 people, around 200 people, and be able to then distill what were the smallest number of things that made the biggest difference in a sense. One of my questions is the opposite of that, meaning could there be 200 failed entrepreneurs, all of whom had the six essential skills, but, you know, so that the six essential skills aren't in effect the determinant of success, but they're there, but they're also there to people who haven't succeeded. I don't know that I'm asking my question in a very clean way, but it goes to, you know, how we know these are the six.
So in academic speak, that's called the pushback on this type of a data set is sampling on a dependent variable, right? So you could say that the methodology that's used academically is called grounded theory method. It's a qualitative research type of methodology. I'm trained as a sociologist, so you see this quite frequently in sociology, in psychology, in anthropology. This is the way that you can talk to people and get and inform a large data set. The question that you're asking is a good one, and it is one that people ask, which is, you know, do failures have these same six skills? And I cannot tell you definitively with a research-based framework that they do or do not. But what I can tell you is that I studied the Olympic athletes of entrepreneurship, basically, and figured out what the top skills are of the very best performers. And so we do want a pattern after the very best performers. You know, would there be failures out there that also did some of these six skills? Maybe. Would there be failures out there that did all of these six skills? I think unlikely, but possible. I can't completely eliminate that from the counterpoint of a data set. So it's the famous quote, you know, of all happy families look the same and all unhappy families are unhappy in different ways. There are, you know, 10,000 ways in which startups fail. And I did not go out and eliminate all of those things. So what I can tell you with very high degree of confidence and certainty and the largest data set that we have in the U.S. now from these top academic institutions is that this is the pattern by which we know people succeed. And so that's why we're teaching Stanford MBAs these six skills, because we really do believe that it advantages people. But to your question, you know, I cannot eliminate the idea that someone might do these things and still not succeed.
Thank you. And the were there examples of, because I think this is also really interesting to read the six and to think, yes, I agree they're a good idea, but I'm not necessarily able to bridge the gap between knowing it's a good idea and actually executing on them. And was there anything that you saw, and maybe it's one of the six themselves, that enabled the people who were successful and who executed on these things that predisposed them to execute, in effect, on a good idea, on and that you know others might recognize it, but the difference becomes really, can you follow through on it?
So I think that once we start talking about what the six are, they actually step right through spotting an opportunity, find the gap is number one, and then driving for daylight is two, flying an OODA loop is a decision framework, it's three. So this is actually how you do execute. And so I actually think that question is answered by looking at the six skills themselves. You know, a macro concept, and this is a way to get into this conversation, is around curiosity. And I do think finding a gap, which you have to spot an opportunity or find a gap in a marketplace to start, that has a lot to do with being curious. And there's some great research right now at the University of Chicago that's saying you need to scratch the itch of curiosity, meaning you have to know a little something in order to be curious and ask questions. You can't be a completely blank slate, right? You can't have no knowledge at all. You need a little bit of knowledge, and then you need to keep probing and asking and being childlike in the wonder of why something works, why it doesn't, where's the friction point, how do you solve a problem other people haven't solved. You have to keep probing. And the creators that can scale their ideas, they do that. You also cannot believe you're an expert. If you think you're a complete expert at something, you're no longer curious. Right. So this in the business world is a trap. In most of life, it's a trap. If you think you're older and wiser, you're experienced, you have the title, the salary, the corner office, whatever it is, you're the academic that knows the most about something, and there, you know, you could eliminate any question. That is a real trap. for a fast-moving economy. And so you want to scratch the itch of curiosity by continuing to probe and ask questions. And that is a universal thing. All six of these things are universal to the data set. But I think, you know, as something that all of us experience in life all the time, we can be asking questions. And that's just a good place to start.
And I love the distinction that you make that being curious doesn't mean not knowing stuff, that actually to be curious in a powerful, useful, valuable way requires that you know stuff enough to be curious about other stuff that you don't know. And it's kind of this combination. I talk about this a lot. It's a combination of confidence and humility. You don't often see it in people, but you know, humility without confidence in some ways gets you nowhere. And confidence without humility is what you were just describing, where you're an expert and you have nothing to learn. So it sounds like you're describing this sort of combination, which is that you know enough and you're still open and curious.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, one of the macro ideas out of my research is that you have to be comfortable being uncomfortable. So there's another way to think about it. You know, if you are really comfortable in your job, in your knowledge base, in your life in general, that often leads to complacency. And that's the Achilles heel in a fast-changing world. You have to be willing to be uncomfortable, keep asking questions, say you don't have the answer, be willing to look again, be willing to reach out and find allies and, you know, partner in new and different and maybe uncomfortable ways. And that ability is what also drives you forward to success. So, you know, there are different ways of thinking about it, but it is this constant learning, constant evolution, constant curiosity that drives the really most successful people.
So in Find the Gap, you're talking about spotting opportunities that others don't see. And in the book, you talk about different ways of doing that, transplanting ideas from one place to another, merging ideas, bringing them together, and kind of designing totally new ways of moving forward. It's all, in some ways of being creative. This idea of like you're seeing the gap, but you're also really creative in looking at ways of closing the gap. And I think that maybe brings us to number two, what you call drive for daylight.
Right. So drive for daylight, once you've spotted something in a marketplace, and, you know, just to stay on Find the Gap for a second, in the financial world or a financial marketplace, we talk about arbitrage, right? There are moments in a financial marketplace, there are glitches where you can see something, you can pounce on it. That is the same thing in an entrepreneurial landscape. You can see a problem that hasn't been solved and, you know, go for that glitch, build something there. You can love something that other people don't necessarily know about yet, and there's a real opportunity, your passion, right? So there's entrepreneurial glitches, gaps, arbitrage. And so once you've been able to see something, the skill too about driving for daylight is that you have to take a long horizon view on that. So there is a moment in time that's a gap. And then you have to say, okay, let me grab a hold of that and believe that this can be built into something that is a long-term purpose, a long-term mission, and that I will drive towards a future that has this in it. And the analogy is that you have to manage speed like a race car driver. So a driver of a fast-moving car, and I actually enrolled myself in NASCAR driving school to test this analogy, you have to have your hands on the wheel, but you have to always look forward. So not the lines on the pavement, which would be, you know, the rules of traditional business, not the competitors, the cars next to you, or that would be benchmarking to past performance, and certainly not looking back in a rearview mirror. That would be previous success in business. You have to always be looking for the light on the horizon, what's ahead. So that's the drive for daylight concept.
I'm wondering, as you're speaking, if you could share with us some examples, because you've got so many great examples in the book. And I'm just even thinking about SpaceX. I can't remember if you used SpaceX as an example for drive for daylight, but it's such a clear example of really looking at the horizon and going for something that, you know, I think maybe you use Airbnb in the book, but it's, But it's such an example of looking far into a future that none of us can really see even, and maybe still can't see, and yet they're going for it.
Sure. So the SpaceX example, so all of the examples, all of the founders in this book, the creators, they all have each of the six skills. So we can substitute any example in for any of these skills. Airbnb, I think, does open that chapter, their long horizon view on, you know, disrupting and changing the way people travel, disrupting traditional hotels. But SpaceX, as an example, is Elon Musk truly believing that life as we know it needs to be multi-planetary, as he says. So when I first sat down to interview him, and I interviewed him a couple times for this book, you know, he starts by saying, giving me an evolutionary history. So originally life is single-celled, and then it's multi-celled, and then life goes from oceans to land, and it's mammals and consciousness and humans as we know it. And the future is to live on multiple planets. And that is very long horizon problem to solve. Right. Most of us are not thinking in evolutionary terms. Elon is, and believing that we do need to explore space. And so what he did originally was try to see if NASA would do this or try to reinvigorate the U.S. space program. He wanted to do a little greenhouse. He was thinking that he would just fund, because he had already exited PayPal at the time, as a philanthropist, he would try to get a greenhouse set up on planet Mars and partner with NASA to do that. And no one at the U.S. space program was even talking about going to Mars or exploring that as a destination for landing aircraft. And so then Elon went to the Russians and tried to figure out if Russia was doing it, and the Chinese. He was trying to figure out what government to partner with. No government was actually looking at doing it, so he said he would stand up his own company as a forcing function to try to put some pressure on government programs to also look into this. And SpaceX, you know, is in Hawthorne, California. He has also thought that if you could make a reusable rocket, the price of building aircraft and exploring space would be significantly less. So right now, if we fly between San Francisco, where I live, and London, we do not throw away the jet aircraft, or it would be very expensive to travel just, you know, from one continent to another. We have thrown away the rockets of any space exploration mission that we've done. So instead, Elon is designing reusable rockets, and we've seen this succeed. It's taken years to land a reusable rocket on a platform out in the ocean, but SpaceX has done that over the summer, in the last year. And the long horizon view is that we will have rockets blow up, as we've also seen, but that will not deter this company, SpaceX, and hopefully others, from taking the mission of believing that we could colonize another planet at some point. Elon and that company, SpaceX, they have taken over NASA's contracts to resupply the International Space Station. They're doing that, and they do that at 1/10 the price that NASA did. So, you know, this is proving out a business model and a case that you can build cheaper rockets, and private sector companies can resupply the International Space Station. And hopefully, you know, Elon's idea is that within his lifetime, he's in his mid-40s now, he's just hoping by the time he's 80 that this problem has been solved and we somehow are able to support life on planet Mars, right, as a first step. So that is very much a long horizon view. And that's, you know, uncharacteristic to most businesses, but that's sort of the mega example, I guess, of driving for daylight.
It is a mega example for sure. Fly the OODA loop.
Yeah. So that is OODA stands for Observe, Orient, Decide, Act. And this is originally an Air Force framework, fighter pilot framework for making fast decisions in combat and outmaneuvering a competitor. And so when you take this into the business marketplace, what it requires is to really be alert and observe things and then orient as quickly as you can to them, again, by asking questions and using, in many cases, data analytics, being smart and on how you evaluate things, and then making decisions quickly and taking actions quickly. And when you can do that, you can outmaneuver, you can learn faster, you can get inside the loop of a competitor. Your competitor is reacting to a decision that you made and they're a split second behind. So that's the concept.
And it's also, I guess, the concept that relates to the question I was asking earlier, which is how do you actually put this stuff into practice? And you know, in part, the answer is in that particular skill is it's all about putting it into practice. It's all about looking at what's happening and figuring out how you want to shift your own behavior, the behavior of people in your organization, in order to take into account the reality of what's happening out there and to address it with your own product, with your own behavior.
Yes. Yeah, so each one of these skills actually is pretty practical, where in this case, it's about making fast decisions and knowing that you can make a decision and then you can make another decision, that you can keep making informed decisions and one good decision will lead to another good decision, and that it's not a to be or not to be kind of land, which is a lot of businesses. You know, been about thinking through things and making strategic plans and, you know, predicting a 5-year future and doing all of those things. And as we're more globally linked and technology accelerated, it's about making fast decisions and then knowing that you can continue to make more decisions, right, and continue to navigate. So that's a very tactical and sort of practical framework to put into play.
You talk in one of the fourth one is fail wisely, and you talk about a ratio. And my question always for this one is, how do you set the right ratio? Because I imagine it's different for every organization, the right ratio of failure, and certainly how do you hone resilience? Because we all know people for whom, and this is as individuals and it's also as organizations, but obviously organizations are driven by people, how our tolerance for failure and our capacity to bounce back after failure is you know, in some ways very hard to control. So teach us a little bit here about failing wisely and setting a failure ratio.
So the idea, the ingoing idea is that you will not be perfect. So the ratio is, for example, 1 in 3 things I try won't work, and that's what I want. And that's what the Stella & Dot founder, Jessica Herron, that's her ratio. And she runs one of the fastest growing fashion businesses. It's all through a direct selling workforce of women stylists. They're backed by Sequoia, one of the big venture backers out here. And what Jessica says in that fashion inventory line is 1 in 3 things that they try as products won't work. But she just wants her stylist workforce to say, love it or lose it, as fast as possible. And then they lose 1/3 of the inventory quickly. They shed it and they figure out a better style, a better fashion, something that is better adopted in the marketplace. You know, you might have a 1 in 10 ratio in going in a more capital-intensive industry. Back to Elon Musk and Tesla Motors. You don't actually probably want 1 in 3 things at Tesla to not work, because that's a massive, you know, when you're manufacturing a car,
right?
That's capital intensive, and that's at a whole different level. There's, you know, big inventory in there and big factories and everything else. But you also don't want a zero tolerance for failure. A zero ratio would be a perfect record, and we know that's not possible in today's business landscape. So maybe at Tesla, the ratio is 1 in 10 things that they try won't work. Google's ratio is 70-20-10 for management time. 70% of time on core business, 20% of time on side business related to the core, and 10% of time on total moonshots. And that's how they direct the, you know, the business leadership team to direct their own time. So the point here is that we each can set our own ratio, depending on what industry we're in, depending on what station of life we're in. You know, if we have kids in college and we're paying big tuition and, you know, our risk tolerance is lower at that moment, that's okay, but it just can't be zero. And the idea then on the flip side of resilience is that you know you will get it wrong, and that's what you want, because that means you're learning. That means you're innovating. That means you're on this entrepreneurial curve. If you actually do have a perfect record, you haven't tried anything new. So the way to think about failure is small bets, incremental failures to avoid catastrophic mistakes, and the fact that you're getting it wrong sometimes is actually what you want. You know, and that helps, I think.
I think the Google example is an interesting example because it's not a ratio per se. It's sort of a time frame. Spend 10% of your time on things that you can expect to fail, and hopefully some of them will succeed. But it's when I'm thinking about how do you encourage people to take risks who are risk averse, you know, there's actually something powerful in saying, you know, out of a day, take 45 minutes and work on stuff you expect to fail. And it creates a very interesting cordoned off space for failure that for people who are risk averse may otherwise have a hard time kind of handling.
Yeah, I think that you have to build it in. And that's the point about having a ratio at the outset, is that you don't go back at the end. The real danger, and this is how, by the way, we've taught people across the world, in the US is the data set, but we have told people in the education system there is a right answer. And you can be a 4-point student, you can have a perfect SAT score, whatever it is, you can, you know, be a linear thinker and you can come up with the right answer. In today's world of work, in the marketplace, we really don't know what the right answers are. The business landscape has shifted so much that in my father's business career, you could think that you could take risk out of a system and scale a working idea, take a working idea global. But in today's world, we don't know where those ideas are coming from. They could come from anywhere. And so you can't believe that you could have a zero failure outcome, or that you could take risk completely out of a system. Instead, the set your own ratio at the outset basically frees you up to realize that the best possible outcome is to fail a little bit all the time so that you're on the edge and you're moving forward.
So we only have a little bit of time left. Let's talk about network minds.
Okay, so networking minds is about harnessing the brain power of other people. And the idea here is that you really want cognitive diversity. You want to try to figure out the diverse mindsets and the diverse skill sets and the points of view that other people can bring to solving a problem. And, you know, we talk about diversity, what people look like on the outside a lot, like race, gender, socioeconomic differences. That's the visible diversity that we can see. My research set is saying, no, that's not actually what matters. The cognitive diversity that's inside your mind and what brain power you bring, that's what will solve problems that we haven't solved in the past. So if you can network diverse types of brain power, and people may look similar or different, but you really want this diverse brain power to come together in on and offline forums to solve problems.
It's a little bit actually synonymous with find the gap, where in finding the gap, you're merging ideas or you're bringing diverse ideas into the sort of reality of what you're going to shoot for. And here that's the equivalent, but if I'm understanding it correctly, but in terms of minds, like you want diverse minds that are going to work on a problem and that they're going to see things that otherwise similarity might miss.
So in Find the Gap, one of three ways of finding a gap is to be an integrator, as I'm calling it. So combined, you know, different ideas at an intersection. So Chipotle is an example where Steve Ells, the founder himself, is a classically trained chef. And then he has disdain for fast food, but he thinks to himself, you could make fast food, you could combine fast with casual restaurants and cook for the line. The longer the lineup of people is, the more you cook, the shorter the line, the less you cook. And he creates fast casual as a whole category of restaurant. But that's him spotting a gap as a classically trained chef. This idea of networking minds is a little different, which is if you really want to solve something in your business that isn't working, if you've bumped into something that is just not solvable by yourself alone, what you need to do is go, if you're an extrovert, go find an introvert and ask them how they would see something. If you're trained as a computer scientist, go find a journalist. if you're a mathematician, find an anthropologist and say, help me think about this to solve this problem. And you can do that, you know, through online vehicles. A prize competition would be a way, you know, post a prize and attract brain power that lives in Romania, right? Or lives in China or lives in, you know, who knows where, in Germany, to help solve your problem. Or in a real, you know, physical sense, not on a virtual platform, but write on a whiteboard, write on a wall, and get five other people in your physical office space to come over and look at what you wrote and get those brains to help you brainstorm about it. That's different than if you write on a sheet of paper on your desk by yourself and you're just using your own brain capability. If you put it up on a vertical surface and attract four other people to come over, in your defined office space, you've actually networked minds right there. So that's kind of a couple ways to do that.
Got it. And finally, gift small goods.
Yeah, so gifting small goods, that's the last skill. And that's about a small good is a small kindness or something of value for someone else in the workplace. Gifting it forward is about being generous with your help. And the concept is that if you are collaborating and you're helping in small ways, that other people, your reputation is very amplified. Other people will talk about that. And because of transparent technology, we'll know about that. This is the basis of LinkedIn. So we can find each other on LinkedIn. I could find information in Google or Facebook or Twitter. I could send a text. I could send an email. There's very fast communication around, are people good to work with, your reputation. If you're gifting small goods and helpful, information comes to you, people want to work with you, deal flow comes to you, you attract a lot that makes you more productive at work. If the flip side is also true, if you are not gifting small goods, but you're cheating people or hoarding resources, or, you know, that will also be transparently known increasingly with the technology and amplification of your reputation, and you will get cut out of networks. And there's a research study right now out of Harvard showing that in a real collaborative and, you know, kind of collective entrepreneurial economy, those who are not helpful to others, they do get cut out. People don't want to work with them. They become isolated. And then interestingly, they don't like being isolated. So they are 2 to 3 times more likely to collaborate in the future. So gifting small goods is just a way of watching out for other people, but it's all actually pretty productive as well for the person who is being helpful.
Tell me, Amy, in as a way of closing, I'm curious how, you know, you look at these and they're very, very powerful. They're six, you know, you call them a six essential skills. They feel like even more than skills, right? They're ways of being and leading and showing up in the world that predispose people for success or organizations for success. How has doing this research, learning this research, understanding this impacted the way you lead and the way you act and kind of impacted your work?
So I'd say it's completely and fundamentally changed the way that I think of work. You know, the act of writing a book is also very entrepreneurial. So I'm a first-time writer, and creating this content has been challenging. I mean, in so many ways, I have stepped through the exact same skills that I went out to identify, which is the big surprise to me. Yet to find a gap, I think that there was a gap in the marketplace for books talking about how to create and scale ideas across different domains. The drive for daylight thing, I'm very much a long horizon view. I hope that this is, you know, on the shelf and helping people for years to come. The decision loop, the OODA loop, yeah, I had to observe, decide, you know, act very quickly on who to interview, how to get them, what mattered, sift and sort and keep making decisions. The failing wisely, it's very hard. There are lots of failed drafts and repeats, and you know, getting a book done as a first-time writer is also pretty painful experience. You have to be resilient to get that done. The networking minds thing, I had to get help, right? I had to have editors help. I had to have friends read chapters. I had to have people who were inside my publisher, Simon & Schuster, and outside my publisher, and design a cover and design a website and do all of those things that I didn't know how to do. And in the gifting of small goods, I would also say that I believe the success of this book will come because it helps other people. And the emails that I get or the people that I meet along the book tour and stuff, I feel most proud of that, is the single mothers that come up or the students that come up or the corporate executives that say, hey, you know, inside of our Fortune 100 company, we're trying to get people to do these skills. So I'd say the process itself has changed the way I see work. And I believe it's very available skill set so that each one of us can do these things and accelerate whatever it is, whatever the dream is, of the way that you would apply your time and your talent. So I think it's accessible, and that's really a hopeful kind of message.
The book is The Creator's Code, The 6 Essential Skills of Extraordinary Entrepreneurs. Amy Wilkinson is the author. Amy, thank you so much for being on the Bregman Leadership Podcast.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Bregman Leadership Podcast, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. For more information about the Bregman Leadership Intensive, as well as access to my articles, videos, and podcasts, visit peterbregman.com. Thank you to Claire Marshall for producing this episode, and to Brian Wood, who created our music. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the next great conversation.